Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I'm Josh.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Calvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and are taking baby steps toward maybe loving the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And today, in our mini-sode, we are talking about the third episode of Series 9, Under the Lake, by Toby Whithouse. Would you say Whithouse, or is it Whitehouse? How do the Brits say it?
I would say Whithouse, but I'm an American, so what do I know?
Yeah,
all
and right. They pronounce it T.G. Woodhouse and not Wodehouse, so who knows, right?
We're just going to call him Toby. That's adorable. So this is Under the Lake, written by Toby. And we will start this with round one, Temporal Grace, because we like to start every mini-sode with something we loved about the episode. Kelvin?
I just thought it was cool that there was that the commander, or at least second in command of the base, was a deaf person, and there's no big thing like, hey, look, it's a deaf person. You know, like, wait, what? What's a deaf person doing running things? You know, it's like, it just wasn't a deal.
No, and thus far, there wasn't any huge narrative reason for it either. She did some lip reading, but it wasn't like, it didn't save the day. It was just a skill she had. So hopefully they don't do that in the second half, where the whole thing hinges on happening to have a deaf person to save the day, because then it seems a little cheapened. But I would love it if she just happens to be deaf. And just one of the characters.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the villain doesn't turn out to be like some sort of audio equivalent of the Weeping Angels. So as long as you don't hear them, you know.
Big Finish would love it, but no. It wouldn't work for the second half. Pat?
I'm going to agree with my wife, Carrie, who mentioned when we watched this the other day that she was happy that it's just kind of a straightforward Doctor Who adventure. At least so far in this first half. It's very classic, you know, Patrick Troughton base under siege stuff with not a lot of bells and whistles about big thematics or who the Doctor is or his relationship with, you know, the meta structure of the program. Pretty straightforward stuff, and that's a little refreshing at this stage in the game. Now, that being said, it looks like they're going to do a interesting time travel twist toward the end, which we can talk about more later, and I'm interested to see what part two is going to be like, but at least this first episode was pretty trad, and I'm happy to see that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the traditional aspect of this first part quite a lot. It's sort of an embarrassment of riches for me to pick a favorite part, so I would just pick one, a tiny little moment at random. When the Doctor gives Clara the dirty look when she tries to high-five him, that's probably one of my favorite moments in a long time. Round two, Doctor in Distress. We call it this because they seem determined to make the 12th Doctor a very burdened Doctor, despite the fact that his predecessor erased the Time War. And so we want to take a little look at how the 12th Doctor was portrayed in this episode. And I will kick it off by saying it was one of my favorite parts of this episode was...
Really?
Well, I like the fact that they were softening him around the edges, which I thought they were going to do this season, because some people reacted rather negatively to his abrasiveness, but they made it part of the narrative that the softening was him trying, perhaps sometimes unsuccessfully, to soften up, whether it be the cards with how to respond to people, cartoonish as that might have been, or when he feels obligated to have a sensitive conversation with Clara and the TARDIS and then says, can we stop now? I felt like there was a natural progression of the character as presented in the previous season, as opposed to sometimes the new series sort of just jumps from episode to episode with different takes on the Doctor without much continuity between them.
I think I'm going to be the sour one this time. Thinking through it again, it's like, as much as I like the structure of the Base Under Siege stuff, it's pretty much every line out of everybody's mouth I just couldn't really stand, and the Doctor was kind of high on that list for me, so he was really, really in distress for me. I mean, I dug the flashcards too. I thought that was terrific. And Capaldi can sell a lot of this stuff better than a lot of the other actors who've played the Doctor can, but I'm still not on board with, oh, I want to kiss it to death, and the whole shenanigans related to his thinking that these creatures are somehow ghosts. We'll get into what I think are quite lousy plot mechanics later, I'm sure, but in relation to the Doctor's character, I didn't like this oddball exposition about, what, this is proof of life after death, don't you want to go out there and ask them questions until your throat falls out and say, oh, okay, well, you're a little murdery or whatever, but come on, you know, it's a very weird characterization of the Doctor for me. He's seen consciousness survive after death before, and he's seen alien intelligences taking over bodies before, and it really rang very, very false to me. I didn't understand where they were going with the character, and it was completely implausible to me.
I didn't get that. I was just so happy to see some new school Doctor Who that felt like old school Doctor Who. I didn't find any like weird characterization problems like that. And when the Doctor and Clara had the little personal conversation in the TARDIS, I really liked that because it didn't seem rushed. It didn't seem jumped up. It didn't seem overly cute. I do not have characterization problems here.
I think to comment on what Pat was talking about, it's maybe how we're parsing out this discussion. A lot of the things that Pat pointed to me, were things the Doctor said that were part of the plot. And you can see that as characterization, like the jumping to the idea that ghosts are real. But to me, I thought it was part of the plot and a very intentional thing. The Doctor, who always says ghosts aren't real, and so the plot mechanic is, we're going to say the Doctor thinks ghosts were just invented now, which seemed to be the implication. It was a device that invented ghosts for a scientific purpose. And it was very much a plot point, trying to surprise you because you think you know what the conclusion the Doctor would come to. And whether or not that's ultimately successful, or even whether it was successful in this episode, I didn't take it as part and parcel of the overall characterization of the Doctor this season.
Well, yeah, I mean, just that he finds, you know, a technological reason for how a ghost could happen, which, you know, pseudo-tech reason for why a ghost would happen, and I guess that, I don't know, I'm okay with pseudoscience like that, I guess, I don't know.
I'm okay with the pseudoscience, of course. Oh, God, am I okay with the pseudoscience? I've been a Doctor Who fan for 35 years or something like that, but so maybe this is just the unregenerate atheist in me talking or whatever, but the ghost thing, and especially on top of the Master's Heaven thing last season, has gotten me kind of worrying about metaphysics in Doctor Who. The idea that the Doctor's like, oh, these are ghosts. There is proof that there is life after death now. And even the casual use of the word soul by him later in the episode, which I think may well be a word that has never been heard in Doctor Who before. You know, it's always things like consciousness, things like that. Very anodyne, non-religious terminology.
Mm.
It may be a Toby Whitehouse thing, you know. I never saw Being Human, although my wife is a big fan of it, so I think it may have some sort of reflection on the concerns that explicitly supernatural drama was about, and now here they're kind of being imported into Doctor Who. But for me, these were all like very wrong notes. I know Doctor Who is so syncretic and can take lots and lots of different types of stories and make them work, but for some reason these things, these metaphysical things, are always very troubling to me. They don't they don't operate in the same universe as what I think of as Doctor Who operating in. I don't know. Does that make sense? I don't, you know, it's...
Oh, I, yeah, you're, I totally hear you. And I think Soul did stand out to me. But in me, I just took a part of the more emotional side of New Who. Feelings are going to be more felt. You're not going to talk about consciousness. You're going to talk about soul. It's all a little bigger, a little more romanticized. And I guess I put a question mark on the end of it, waiting for the next episode.
Well, and it clearly can't be ghosts. You know, the logic of the story already demands that they're not actually just ghosts. Well,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why you would leap to that conclusion anyway. They're not acting like the human beings they were before they died. And at the end, we see what is presumably the doctor's ghost. We know the doctor isn't going to die, and so there's going to be some other type of explanation for that. So it will undermine this this metaphysical explanation, at least to some degree. It can't help but do that.
I think it is jumping on the supernatural bandwagon of dramas that are so popular, including, like you said, Being Human and other works where soul is becoming a genre term.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it? Yeah, it's just sort of a... Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have these religious connotations anymore when Buffy and Supernatural and Being Human and all these things can use the term and in very distinct ways to essentially just mean some sort of survival of consciousness after death.
And we thought this would be a short podcast, and now we're into metaphysical discussion. So how about round three, friends and foes? Not as many friends and foes as in the previous two episodes.
No, I wasn't expecting the Tivoli to come back.
No, I didn't even catch that at first. I didn't realize that till after the fact that they were from the God Complex, and then
finally hit me one time when you got the close up of the sort of British Undertaker ghost, and he's got the buck teeth thing, and I'm like, why did they give him buck teeth? And it's like, oh wait, he's that sort of mouse guy from the God Complex.
Wow, you guys, I did not even remember that at all.
Yeah, just they don't have to pay extra royalties or something, I guess. I don't know.
Right,
maybe that was the only reason. I don't know.
He's reusing his self canon.
Yeah, so there might be some weird civilly cultural reason for this bizarre ghost based communication system thing. You know, that's what I'm assuming will be in the next one, but.
Since there's not much to talk about pertaining to ghosts or whatever they're going to turn out to be, maybe we can touch briefly on Clara's characterization in here, where they definitely seem to be pointing at something that will be continuing in the season with her being really into this and possibly to a dangerous degree, even the doctor questioning her enthusiasm.
Yeah, that did seem striking, and I wasn't sure whether that was intentionally a character trait of Clara's right now, or whether it was the show sort of commenting on itself the way it frequently does, like, come on, you know you want to save the world again. So it's sort of cheerleading for itself, the way that we've seen the show do so many times. It makes sense, I guess, that could be a dangerous character trait that's developing in Clara right now, but for me it's hard to distinguish against the sort of ambient background cheerleading.
I picked it out as a sort of connection to last season's implication that Clara was addicted to time travel in an almost irresponsible way, or in a way she couldn't quite control. And then, like you, the initial opening sequence just seemed like the usual new series, rah-rah-rah stuff, but I think when they had the doctor question it, I think that's why they did it narratively, to make the audience go, if she's making the doctor nervous, then we should pay attention to this and assume there's something wrong. So that's what made it stand out to me as a storyline that they might be going with. And if handled well, that's always the big question, it's sort of an interesting idea of a companion who was possibly more into it than the doctor and made him nervous. He's been uncomfortable with companions like Leela killing people and doing other things, but we've never had a companion who enjoyed it too much. I mean, from my point of view, they've had companions that enjoyed it too much, but not within the narrative.
Yeah.
And overall, I think, as we commented in the beginning, it had a more classic doctor and companion vibe, the sort of back and forth and a team, and it didn't seem disproportionate either way, where Clara had to be the superhero and the doctor seemed like the doctor.
yeah, the balance, I think, worked out pretty well. I kept getting hung up on the dialogue and didn't quite groove on that, but as far as the dynamics between the two of them went, yeah, I think that's a good solid balance.
This is going to sound weird, but I kind of liked how they didn't have, like, a whole lot of Clara stuff. They, you know, and I don't mean that as an anti-Clara kind of thing. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like a New Who thing with me, where they try so hard to make some big statement about the characters, and it kind of just gets in the way. I didn't see, like, a whole bunch of sweat from the producer and the director and the writer, like, oh, God, we've got to do something with Clara. You know, it's like, I know, like, more of a zen kind of thing, where it's, you know, oh, Clara just is Clara, so okay.
Well, I'm with you, Kelvin. I don't like a lot of the heavy lifting that people need to do to justify the importance of the characters that we've already agreed to watch on a weekly basis. I mean, if we like the actors and we're familiar with the characters, then we're going to just sort of get enjoyment out of watching them do things that they're going to do, right? They don't need to necessarily self-reflect on it every moment of the day or be the absolute perfect person to do it because of some character trait or element to their personality.
More generic Terry Nation companion.
That's right. We want blank companion.
Round 4, the big picture. And just talk about the story itself, the plot mechanics. And Pat, you mentioned that they irked you, along with everything that came out of everyone's mouth.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty blah all around. I did like the refreshingly straightforward nature of it. And I'm going to contradict myself here and say that I liked the twist at the end where he's going to go back in time and discover what's caused this whole business. Now, I thought every bit of the plot machinery up to that point was totally creepy. Oh, well, I can't go and get Clara and the other people in the TARDIS because the TARDIS doesn't want to go near those ghosts. Okay, all right, that's sort of hand-wavy or whatever. But, you know, it's simply much easier to go back in time and discover what's caused this thing in the first place, and then that's somehow the better solution. Well, it's certainly the better solution from a point of view of narrative interest, and so I'm happy to see Peter Capaldi go back in time and figure that out. It was not at all convincing on a straightforward narrative level. If I was a game master in a role-playing game, I wouldn't have tried to pull that on my players, right? But anywho, so he's going to go back in time, and he's going to figure it out, and that's all good, because this is actually not something that we see in Doctor Who really all that often. I'm going to get in the TARDIS, and I'm going to go back to an earlier point in time, and I'm going to figure out some plot point. The only one that immediately comes to mind is City of Death, where he goes back and visits Leonardo da Vinci. I'm sure there are others, and I'm sure there are probably more in the new series that I'm forgetting right now, but it's still novel to me. Like, we're going to go backwards into the plot, and we're going to do some backfilling, and I'm pretty excited to see how that's going to go. I don't, you know, as shaky as I thought this first part was, I do have high hopes for the second part.
Because I rode along on the atmosphere of this piece, and I will say my bias comes in here in that, honestly, divorced from the other 9 years of the new series, partially I was drawn to this episode because this is kind of how, in my fevered nerd dreams, I imagined what a base-level, average, modern Doctor Who series would be before the series got rebooted. That it would be a older Doctor, that there would be emotional high notes and companions that were human and had romances, but that he wouldn't understand it. He'd be on the outside of all the modernity to a certain extent. And that it would be a sort of updated version of the kind of plots we saw from the classic series. So that might have been what appealed to me and why I wrote over plot bumps. But honestly, things like hand-waving stuff about the TARDIS doesn't want to go near the ghosts and I'll just go back in time instead does not seem that out of place for all of Doctor Who, honestly.
Yeah.
Because what it does do is get you to a more interesting place, and it's inconsistent from episode to episode what device or what plot mechanic prevents him from using the TARDIS as anyone in their right mind would use it most of the time. So those kind of things, while I can see that point outside of the realm of Doctor Who, it doesn't bother me. And I enjoyed the tense scenes of chasing the ghosts down the corridors, and I thought it was well directed and well done. And I really loved the performances for the most part. They kind of killed off, I think, some of their better actors early on or turned them into ghosts. I thought the captain, just in his couple minutes scene in the cold open, was really kind of compelling.
I like the guy with the glasses who, it took me forever to figure it out. He looks very similar to the guy who plays the husband on the show The Blacklist. It might just be the glasses, but I'm like, who is that guy? It's totally not that guy, but it totally looks like that guy.
He does.
So yeah, I liked all those secondary actors.
I thought it was odd that this is like 100 plus years into the future and that they were still making reference to Cabin in the Woods.
Are people going to be talking about Cabin in the Woods the way we talk about, I don't know, Wizard of Oz today or something?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that it becomes a Citizen Kane type of thing as we discovered in huge cultural significance in 100 years.
The most significant film of the 2010s.
Oh, we should score it. So, Calvin, what would you give it?
I you know what, I really liked it. I was very involved with what was going on. I'm going to give it 4 empty eye sockets and half of a torn 3x5 milk card.
Dad?
I'm going to give it 2.5 ambiguous souls.
You guys have stolen all of my ratings.
Well, that's why we go first.
Yep. 4. I'm going to stick with empty eye sockets because that was my first choice. You know, Kelvin stole it.
Ah, you saps.
It's been a while since we've had a fairly significant opinion difference on an episode.
I'm just a bitch this week, you guys.
And I still say Florida Doomsday is a good Fifth Doctor episode, but so
all right, well, round 5 is wild speculation, whether it be on part 2 of this episode or on season hints that may have popped up in here.
One thing that kind of jumped out at me, and I'm a little really worried about this, is the weird sea serpent mural that's in, like, the rec room. That seemed like an odd detail to put in a base. I don't know. You know, some sort of former military installation, now mining installation. It just said, sea serpent mural. You know, I'm like, well, why is there a sea serpent mural there? I bet that's foreshadowing something. And all I can think about is the damn moon dragon thing from Kill the Moon.
Oh.
Is that going to be like some sort of Deus Ex Machina thing for the finale, where like this the impossibly giant space dragon thing just comes in and wipes out a bunch of Daleks or something? I don't know about other people, but I personally would really kind of hate that.
That's some wild speculation, Calvin.
it's Kill the Moon has given you post-traumatic stress disorder.
Maybe it did. I don't know. Yeah.
My guess is it'll play some significance in the second half of this, because they did really linger on that, and it was an odd detail to have in the base. So I agree with you totally. I feel like I should assure you that I think it has nothing to do with the moon dragon.
I did see some weird online image thing from some geek news source that said there's a little weird Easter egg in that sea serpent mural. Apparently the three figures on the ship that it's surrounding, they seem to be Kirk, Spock, and Scotty from Star Trek.
Ooh.
I had a gold shirt, a blue shirt, and a red shirt, and they're like, you know, it kind of looks like little mini figures of Star Trek characters.
Oh, and speaking of Easter eggs, and I don't know if this is true because I saw it online, that one of the note cards that the doctor flashed through at the end was an apology to someone for dropping them off in Aberdeen, which would have to be a Sarah Jane Smith reference.
I did not catch that whatsoever until I saw it online, too, yeah.
But I have no idea what's going to happen in the next episode, but I kind of enjoy that, other than I think it's pretty obvious that it's the doctor's body in that suspended animation coffin. And that's probably how his ghost soul will get put back in. Maybe that's just alien bodies still imprinted on my brain, like Till the Moon is imprinted on your brain.
I swear, you guys, I would always much rather watch the Doctor Who episodes that the two of you create in your head than the ones that wind up on screen, because it's invariably disappointing to me, but your stuff, wow, it's like alien bodies. Oh, it's the Moon Dragon from Kill the Moon. It's much more interesting than what I think is going to happen, which is that Peter Capaldi's going to go back in time and going to have some nonsense explanation why they're not really ghosts, and they're going to use that that energy cell that's missing, right? They made a point of saying that, where did this one go? And he's going to blow up the whatever he's going to have to blow up, and all of a sudden
and
be fine.
One other thing. Why did the ghost not kill Lund?
Yeah, that's got to be a plot point, too.
I thought they said it was because he hadn't seen the writing in the ship.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He didn't get the message to transmit. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're still freaked out about the mural. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. I just got flashbacks. It's like I'm in Nam again. I could smell the jungle.
Anyone have any other parting last thoughts?
I'm hopeful about this. I was expecting a much more, like, sedate, laid-back, not trying to be anything terribly great kind of episode, after all the, you know, the theory of the first two episodes with, you know, Daleks and Davros and all this, and the Master and Missy and all this. And, so I was kind of just pleasantly surprised. It did not seem phoned in to me.
Excellent.
For me, I feed on your optimism, you guys. It sustains me.
Well, as long as you're sustained, Pat, I think this is a good time to sign off. We will be back next week to talk about Before the Flood, also by Toby Whithouse.
P.G. Whithouse.
P.G. I wish.
Let's call him Ferdinand Berkowitz. I don't know.
That sounds good. Let's see if Mr. Berkowitz can save this two-parter next week.
Yeah.
Until then, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Calvin.
And we're saying, get up.
Get up.
World! World!
World!
World!